You're listening to the Weekly Sermon Podcast from Trinity Church Denver. To find out more about Trinity, visit our website at trinitychurchdenver.org. And be sure to subscribe to this podcast in your favorite podcast player to get the latest episodes as soon as they're available. And now, please enjoy the sermon.
A few summers ago, my wife and I traveled. We went on a long road trip. We dropped our kids off at Kanakuk, and we went to Glacier National Park. We went to a number of other places and camped out as well. But at Glacier National Park, that was kind of the goal, was to get there to camp for 3 or 4 nights, to take some hikes, kind of get some time alone in our tent, and that was weird. Basically just enjoy what Glacier National Park is. If you've never been to Glacier National Park, I think it is the most beautiful place I've ever been in the United States, maybe in the world. It is breathtaking and stunning. And so our last day in the park, we were going to be spending hiking the Highline Trail. It's a really famous trail in Glacier National Park. I highly recommend it. I mention it often in sermons because it's filled with wonderful sermon illustrations, because about half the trail is like a straight drop-off on your left and a sheer wall on your right and goats coming towards you. And so the day before that, we were going to just take some time, relax by a lake. And so we got up early, we drove over to a different part of the park, got out, hiked just a short way, it was about a mile, hiked a short way from our car to the edge of this lake, sat on the edge of this lake, and it was beautiful. Sheer mountains on each side, blue glacial waters in front of you, this nice kind of rocky beach that we sat upon. And we sat there, soaked our feet in the really cold water, and had a really great time. Right next to where we were sitting was a small dock with one boat. And we'd noticed that every few minutes, a boat would leave, filled with people who would walk down the beach, get on the boat, and the boat would go all the way down around the end of the lake, beyond where you could see. And so we asked somebody, hey, where does this go? They said, well, it leads to another trail, which leads to another lake, which leads to another trail, which leads to the best lake ever. And so knowing that we were going to hike the Highline the next day, which is kind of a difficult hike, we decided, you know what? We're not going to take the boat. That's $5. That's dumb. So what we're going to do is we are going to hike because there's a trail and it goes around this lake and it goes to the next trail. We're going to take that trail. And then instead of taking the boat across the next lake, we're going to take the next trail and we're going to go on and so forth until we get to the magical lake at the very end of this thing. And we're tough and we're awesome. And we're just going to go. And so we began this journey walking down this trail. In the beginning, it was great. It was nice, beautiful views, walking through a nice, clean trail. We get to kind of the other point beyond where you could see, and suddenly the trail changed. And the trail changed in this way. Before, you could see the trail, and after this, you can't see the trail. It's large, bushy, green things. Plants, I guess they'd be called. Overgrowing the trail, you can't really see. You kind of see occasionally where the trail is still underneath there, but the thing is completely overgrown. And so we begin in our chacos, mind you, walking sandals, walking, if you don't know what chacos are, walking through this nice trail through the green things. And then we begin to notice noises. And at one point, I actually feel something across my foot, like slithery. I don't know if that's a good way to describe the feeling, but it was something like that. At which point I admittedly screamed and jumped. And then we began to notice, and instead of looking out at all the beauty around us, we started looking down at the trail we were on, started paying attention to where our feet were actually stepping. And this is not an exaggeration. Sometimes I'll occasionally exaggerate, but this is not an exaggeration. I mean, hundreds of snakes. Okay, 30 snakes, shooting across the trail everywhere, as we're walking. We're disturbing these, I'm sure, very amicable snakes, and they're shooting across the trail. And so we, in our sandals, remind you, begin high-kneeing. If you weren't an athlete in high school, it's where you run with your knees high through to keep your feet off the ground as quickly as possible. Running down this trail, avoiding the snakes. And this pattern repeated 2 other times as we continued to walk down these trails, around these lakes, to get all the way to the end. And we get to the end, and now we've hiked about 3.5-4 miles We're at this beautiful lake, which it truly was beautiful. But you know what? The only thing I could think of as we sat at that beautiful, stunning lake was, how do we get back without the snakes? Some of you are probably fine with snakes. I'm not. I hate them, and I don't want them to touch my feet. And so at that point, as the tourists are getting off their boat that they took and paid the ticket for, and we can't do that now, you're sitting there and realizing, like, there's nowhere else to go now except for to go back down a trail to get all the way back to our car, or I guess we could just lay down and die. But the two choices before us are to keep going down the path, which is going to lead to nowhere, or to go back the path we just came, or to stop going, just to sit there. And eventually we just said, hey, we're going to go back. We tried a different trail to get back instead of going through the snakes. There were still snakes and deer, which balanced out the snakes, but it was a path. It was a path that you had to go down. And when you weren't paying attention to where you were stepping, I like to pretend like it was filled with danger. Like, you didn't realize that you were surrounded by snakes. You didn't realize that there were snakes shooting across the trail. You didn't realize that now we've gotten finally to the end of the trail, 3.5 miles down the way, and we have to go back. We have to figure out a way to go forward. And we're just a little bit stuck. But we're not stuck because we made some dramatic decision. We're stuck because we took lots and lots of steps. I don't know how many steps are in 3.5 miles, but a lot of steps. Steps that over the course of a long period of time brought us to a point, led us through some overgrown snake-infested woods, got us to a beautiful spot, but now we don't know where to go from here. As we've been considering the nature of wisdom, as we've been considering the reality that the heart of what Proverbs provides for us is the fact that we have a Father, a good Father, a loving Father, who doesn't just want us to be righteous. He doesn't just want us to be holy. He doesn't just want us to be religiously kind of in the right camp. He actually is a Father who wants to teach us how to live well. We've learned that God is a God who wants to teach us how to live well. And one of the things that he's going to begin to kind of, as we take a step through chapter 4, we're going to begin to see is that the heart of what living well is not about these kind of heroic moments that highlight our life. Rather, it's thousands upon thousands of small steps that get you to a point somewhere. And then learning how to address each of those steps, learning how to pay attention to where your feet are right now, not waiting for that moment someday, and not waiting for that moment someday when you'll get married, not waiting for that moment someday when you'll finally get the job you want rather than one you have, waiting for that moment someday when you're finally out of your parents' house and in college, or out of college and finally kind of starting the life you imagine for yourself, that life is not made up of those moments primarily, but rather primarily have to do with what will your attitude be right now? What words are going to come out of your mouth this afternoon? Where will your feet walk next? But what are the next 3 steps? How are you going to get through that bit of trail where there's lots of snakes shooting across the trail? Is it time for high knees? Like, these are the kinds of questions that God is deeply concerned with in the book of Proverbs. We talked about in the first week how everywhere else in the Bible you find these sweeping, universal themes that have to do with God's purposes on the earth, what he's doing over thousands and thousands of years, over every nation, tongue, and tribe on earth. And in Proverbs, that grand sweep kind of finds itself reduced down to, how will you respond to that harsh word from your neighbor? What will you do? What time will you wake up on Tuesday morning? And so we turn to Proverbs chapter 4 as we continue kind of our last week in this 3-week introduction to what Proverbs is trying to teach us, how it's setting up everything else we're looking at. And so the first thing I want you to see is that that Proverbs chapter 4 is deeply concerned with setting in front of us a metaphor. And the metaphor, it pops up all the way through chapter 4, is this idea of walking along a path. That it sets before us a vision of life that is akin to how do you walk? So that wisdom is primarily concerned with two questions. One, what path are you walking down? Which trail did you choose? And two, how are you walking? What is your posture as you walk? In other words, it's not primarily concerned with the destination. It's not primarily concerned with saying, hey, there's this really great lake, three lakes down. It's primarily concerned with, hey, you can take the trail on the right, which looks really pretty and goes over those cliffs, but eventually leads to snakes, or you can take the trail on the left, which still has some snakes, but now you'll get to have deer as well. It's primarily concerned with which trail are you choosing, and as you walk, what is your posture? Where are your eyes? What words are coming out of your mouth? What are you paying attention to? And so this is, in fact, how life works. We live in a day and age, and we're inundated with movies that primarily tell the story of life being defined as, your character being defined as, these decisive, big, heroic moments. And so you look back at your life, and your the movie that immediately pops in my head, which is not a great movie to think of at this point, is X-Men, in which one of the heroes in the story keeps telling one of the heroes that, hey, like, your definition as a hero will be defined by a handful of moments where you make the right choice. And we live in a world that says if you can come to the plate and appear at the right moment, if you think about even growing up, how many times if you liked baseball or if you liked basketball, you would go in your backyard and you'd hit your home run. It was always not just a regular at-bat in the middle of the season. It was Game 7, World Series, inning number 9, bases loaded, you're down by 3. And so you would take the bat. If you're an only child, you did this. If you weren't an only child, you didn't maybe experience this as often. You would take your bat. I was an only child. And so you would go out to bat, and you would, of course, it'd be full count because you'd watch a couple pitches go by that you maybe should have swung at. And then the right pitch comes down, and you swing at it, and you hit it, and of course, it's a home run. And if you were particularly arrogant, it was an inside-the-park home run because you're super fast. It's always those decisive moments, right? So you begin to think of your life, your career, as these moments when you hit the home run, the moment where you sunk kind of the three-point shot, the moment when you came up with the billion-dollar idea that transformed your company or became the conduit through which you started your company. But we do this with parenting too, right? You think that the whole formation of my child's character is going to come down to one or two conversations. I mean, this is the conversation. I'm going to take them for coffee, and we're going to talk about girls, if I'm with my son. And this conversation, the next 2 hours, are going to define the course of their life and their relationship with women forever. Do you know that it never works that way? Like, it really doesn't. I remember when my kids were younger, and I would think, like, this moment, this decisive moment where I take them out to breakfast, this will be the thing they remember when they're 40, and they are reminiscing about me to their friends. They'll talk about, I just remember that morning. My dad took me to breakfast, and we talked about courage. Oh, how wise he was. That's just not how parenting works. Like, the way that my children are formed are not by these one-off decisive conversations where I prepared for, even had an outline, had a little journal page, really prepared for this thing, and now my children are wise because they heard me speak for 2 hours about the nature of courage, and he was just, my son was so inspired that he's now just courageous. No, the way that he is formed is millions, please hear that, millions of tiny choices. Small conversations. It usually, never scripted. Watching me respond to a scary situation in my life. watching his mother and I interact and argue and disagree, and how that gets resolved. The way that my children are formed is never, please, never that one-off decisive conversation. It happens through thousands upon thousands upon thousands of small interactions and facial expressions and reactions to situations where you want to blow up and you don't. Considering, watching just how I'm dealing with tension of around a marriage, tension around my job, tension around just whatever kind of anxiety is pressing upon me. It happens as they watch how I spend my money day in and day out. They watch how I react to a harsh word from someone. They're listening in as you have conversations with your spouse in the car about that person who's just a little bit weird and irritating. They're listening in, they're watching, they're hearing, they're having a million little conversations, watching you act and live, and it's all of those tiny little steps that create and form and shape and define a life. It is almost never the heroic moment. I mean, think about your marriage. Like, I'm sure you've been on one really great date. You got flowers, you got dressed up. Husbands, you looked really nice. In fact, if you're in this room, let me back up. If you're here and you're not married and maybe you're dating someone, almost everything you're experiencing right now is a lie. So you go on a date with this nice man, and he dresses up a little bit. He's very polite. He opens the door for you. You sit down across from one another and have dinner, a really nice dinner. Maybe candlelight involved in this dinner. He takes you home, maybe kisses you on the cheek. That might be too forward, so he just blesses you. and sends you on your way. And the whole dating process is a giant lie, right? It's like a handful of these heroic moments where a guy dresses up and looks better than he will ever look the entirety of your marriage. Do you know how hard I worked to not look obese for my wife when we were dating? So, you put on your best face, you perform your best in these moments. There are just a handful of places where you really have to perform. Does that make a marriage? These 10 or 20 or even 50 dates in which you put on your best clothes and you performed at your best. You thought of questions before the date. You kind of put everything together perfectly. No. What makes a marriage, what defines the character and the nature of a marriage, it's not your anniversary every year. It's not how romantic your husband can be or your wife is once a year as you remember your wedding day. That's the way we approach weddings, right? We spend inordinate amounts of money on weddings. The best food, the best clothing, a dress you'll wear once. All of it. And you could have the most expensive, extravagant, glorious wedding imaginable and have the worst marriage imaginable. The heroic moments don't define a marriage. The thousand conversations you had, maybe without saying a word, the week of your honeymoon, the nods, the looks. 6 months later, when you're suddenly trapped inside a house with a person who never learned to pick up the towel after they took a shower. Like, this is what defines the nature and character of wisdom. It is the step in front of you. Not waiting for that decisive moment or that key conversation or that moment when finally the idea lands on you. It is waking up tomorrow morning and doing the next right thing. And what the author of Proverbs, what Solomon here lays out for us, particularly in this first section, verses 10 to 19, is that these paths go somewhere. And they don't go somewhere because you're first and foremost thinking about the destination. It's that as you walk, even the description here of saying the ways of the wicked are going to cross before you. It's the image here is you're walking down a trail and there's a trail that cuts across. And the temptation is going to be to follow that trail. In other words, the emphasis isn't on the sign that says, hey, this way leads to destruction and damnation and pain. The temptation is going to be it's as you're walking, you're bored. As you're walking, you're forgetting the fact that where you step next matters. And the next thing you know, you've taken a left turn and the steps that you're taking lead you somewhere. And the two paths, the path of wickedness and folly and the path of righteousness and wisdom, they lead to two radically different places. And he describes it for us at the end of that little section. Verse 18, but the path of the righteous is like the light of dawn, which shines brighter and brighter until full day. There's a picture of life that is, as you walk in the path of wisdom and righteousness, things get clearer and clearer and clearer. In other words, it leads to a greater and greater understanding of what life is, of what wisdom is, of how life works. And then the opposite is true for wickedness and folly. To follow that path leads to greater and greater darkness, a deeper sense of lostness and confusion about where you are, to the point that that which caught you, you can't even see, that which is making you fall all over yourself. We've seen this, right? You've seen people, or maybe you've been this person. But you've seen people that you watch them kind of trip all over their own life. Over and over and over and over and over again. And it's like they're oblivious to the very thing that's tripping their feet up. But whereas the way of the righteous, the way of wisdom, leads to a kind of a clear and clear understanding. So that maybe even things that tripped you up back there, mistakes, stupid mistakes, mistakes that you make with money, mistakes you make with your lips and your mouth and what you say, they suddenly become clear to you. And so that further down the trail, you begin to recognize when I do that, it leads to these results, these consequences. I shouldn't do that anymore. In other words, how you walk step by step is taking you somewhere. A life marked by darkness and falling and obliviousness to how you're falling. Or a life of greater and greater clarity. But better understanding. Suddenly the things that you used to trip over, you now know how to step over and go around. But looking down and recognizing there are snakes on the trail and it's time to do some high knees. These trails lead places. A place where your life is marked by darkness. The author here describes a kind of life where people lay in bed at night thinking upon wickedness. They can't go to sleep until they've planned some sort of folly. But where during the day their very food and drink is to do stupid things, to do evil things. This is where they lead. Now, the second half of the proverb. How do we approach then? How do we begin to think about how do we walk down this trail? If the path is righteousness, if the path that we're supposed to take is the way of God, like obeying God, listening to God, following God, doing what God has said, meditating on the words that God has given us, which is really what the whole first section of this chapter is about, what should our posture be? How should we approach life? And it's interesting because verses 20 through 27 are a chiasm. And so that's a poetic structure which kind of helps you, the very way that the poem is structured helps you understand what the actual poem is about. And the key to any chiasm is the place, the line that stands at the very, very center of the chiasm. And that for us is verse 23. And verse 23 is a very famous proverb. It says, the ESV translation is, keep your heart with all vigilance, for from it flow the springs of life. Other translations say, guard your heart with all vigilance. And this was a famous proverb that was told to me all the time growing up as a kid. And so everything else surrounding that center line, we're supposed to interpret or understand in terms of that center line there in verse 23. So the idea here is that we're supposed to guard our hearts. The reason we're supposed to guard our hearts is because out of your heart, whatever the heart is and why you're supposed to guard it, comes a whole way of life, a whole way of living. Everything else in your life flows downstream from your heart. And so then surrounding that is going to be instructions on how we go about guarding our heart, which that's where we're going to end today, is looking at those specific ways, that specific instructions on how we guard our heart. But the very first thing I want us to think about and look at together is, what does it mean to guard your heart? So he's just said that whatever your heart is, coming out of your heart is going to be everything else in your life. How you speak, how you act, how you react to your husband or your wife or your roommate or your next door neighbor. How you go about your work life, how you respond to your kids, how you spend your money. All of that is going to flow from whatever it is that's going on in your heart. So, two questions we need to ask. What is your heart? And two, how do we guard it? What does it mean to guard heart? The heart in the Bible is the source of life. It is the seat of, to use kind of older language, the seat of your affections. It is the foundation of what you love, what you delight in, what you want and fear most in the world. It's connected to your emotions, but it isn't your emotions. It's connected to your will, but it isn't your will. It's in the deepest part of who you are. What do you want? What do you long for? What are you terrified of? What are you willing to give everything to get? The other thing that the Bible tells us about the heart almost everywhere is, one, that it's deceitfully wicked above all things, and two, who can know it? In other words, the first and maybe the most important thing you can know about your heart and why Solomon is telling us to guard it is actually these two things. One, your heart is wicked, and two, you can't know it. It's like a big dark fog. All you can see is what comes out of it. All you can see is what flows downstream from your heart. Which then leads us to Solomon's instructions to guard your heart. Now, interestingly, when I was growing up, my mom used to always say, guard your heart. What she meant by that is, don't listen to Pearl Jam. Specifically, usually. Because Pearl Jam is dark. It's a song. Lots of songs that you shouldn't hear because they will blacken your heart. And so to guard your heart, you should set up a sentry at the door of your heart and not put your cassette tape of Pearl Jam into the tape player and hit play, because evil things will get into your heart and cause your heart to become corrupt, and then your life will be darkened. That's not what this word that's translated keep or guard means. There's two different kinds of guards in the Old Testament, in the book of Hebrews, at least two. And not the book of Hebrews, in the Hebrew language. One means like the guard of a city. You guarded a city gate. And if you were the guard of a city gate and your job was to guard the city gate, your job was to keep bad people out from the city. Guess what? That's not this word. This word has to do with a prison guard, keeping watch over a prisoner. If you're a guard at a prison, your job is not to keep people out, but to keep someone in. I find this fascinating, because I've never heard this text this way, but this is every commentator. So, sorry, just want to... But the idea here is not that, hey, your heart is a nice, pure, wonderful little thing filled with balls of light and joy, and therefore you want to keep the dark Pearl Jam out because they will darken your soul and make you say cuss words and stuff. And that will flow out of you, and that will be, suddenly the well is defiled. That's not the image. The image is not that Solomon is commanding us, hey, stand guard at the door of your heart and make sure nothing bad gets in. Now, what he's saying is there's lots of bad stuff in there. There are desires that will twist and distort your entire life. It will lead you to say things you shouldn't say, to do things you shouldn't do, to chase after things you shouldn't chase after. Keep watch out on it. Don't let it break out. The trope, follow your heart. Solomon's saying, whatever you do, do not follow your heart. Don't do it. So if the heart is dark, if the heart can't really, in the end, be known, all it can be known is the fruits that are flowing out from the heart. How do we keep watch over it? Solomon, using this chiasm, using kind of the two sides of this chiasm, tells us, gives us instructions on how we keep watch on, how we guard our hearts. I'm going to start with the second half first. He uses three different parts of the body in this second half. First, he describes speech. Second, the eyes. And third, the path of your feet. So how do we keep guard? How do we keep watch on? How do we keep our heart in check and at bay? He says, put away from you crooked speech. This idea of crooked speech is going to come up again in a few weeks as we begin to talk about wisdom and speech. But what he commands you to do, what you are decisively to do, is don't say things that distort or undermine or darken the truth. Don't say things that aren't true and beautiful and good. And one commentator noted that the interesting pattern that we see kind of unfold in the book of Proverbs is that what you say does two things. One, it demonstrates what's in your heart. It speaks and exposes what you truly love. But here's the odd thing about our speech. It actually turns back in and shapes what's inside of you, what you love, how you think about the world. I don't know if you've ever experienced this, but maybe you're really, really mad, really, really hurt by someone, and you begin to try to describe, either to other people or even just kind of talking to yourself, describing obviously their intentions, obviously kind of what kind of person they are for them to have done that thing to you. All the while, you're not only saying things that are untrue, not only exposing the fact that you truly hate this person, you're actually beginning to slowly begin to believe the things you say about them. In other words, our words expose what's going on in your heart. You want to keep watch on, guard your heart, watch your words. You want to guard your heart. You want to keep evil at bay. Put all crooked speech far, far away from you. When that thought pops into your head, that offhanded comment, that stupid statement, that statement that is perhaps half true, you maybe even half believe, put it far from you. Amazing how emphatic the entirety of the Bible is about the importance of our speech. Jesus says we will be held accountable for every word that comes out of our mouth. That terrifies me. Not just because I've said things that malign other people, I have, and for that, that's dark, but how many words do I not even think about? Silly words, words that just pop into my head that I say. Proverbs tells us that you want to see what's in your heart, watch the words that come out of your mouth. You want to guard your heart, you want to shape your heart. Watch the words that come out of your mouth. So you have the mouth. And secondly, you have the eyes, and particularly the eyes that are commanded here in verse 25 to look directly forward and your gaze be straight before you. The idea is, again, going back to the earlier part of the chapter where you've been given a trail to walk down, and the temptation is to constantly find ways to get out of the thing that's been put in front of you, right? And so you've been given a trail to walk down, and you're looking left or right, trying to find a way, kind of short circuit, to not be held responsible, to be held accountable for, to be called to this sort of life, this faithful living, step by step by step, on the trail in front of you. Jenny and I were talking about this yesterday morning, and she said it's like we're constantly trying to find ways to find shortcuts, to find easier ways, to find some quick way to riches, to some quick way to happiness, to find some quick way to comfort. I mean, this is why the lottery works, right? One of the things we're going to find out about wealth in the book of Proverbs, not only does it expose the heart, the way that wealth is built is not because you walked into some gigantic inheritance, primarily. It's not because you won the lottery, trust me. It's not because of some big moment in your life. It's because you faithfully approached money day after day after day after day, doing the next right thing in front of you. And yet we're always tempted to look left or right to find a shortcut. We do it with parenting. We want to think, hey, this conversation will seal it. If I can just be loud enough or use the right stories or maybe strike enough fear in them or convince them of how much I love them, if I can just get the right moment, then maybe that will lead to better grades. Maybe that will lead to better character. Maybe that will lead to the fruit that I want to see in their lives. But do you know that we're constantly looking left or right, trying to find some quick way, some switch we can flip that will create the result we want, rather than know, man, this step, then the next step, keep your eyes forward. Just keep doing the next right thing in front of you. So how do you guard your heart? Examine what you're looking for, like the kind of life you're pursuing. Are you looking for shortcuts? Are you even imagining a completely different sort of life than the one that God has given you? Last, the path of your feet. Look at how you live every day. But what is the next step you're taking? The Proverbs are just the least sexy book in all of the Bible, in that it portrays for us the best sort of life is life that's not thinking about 10 years from now, not thinking about retirement, not thinking about the next big thing in your life. It's just thinking about, hey, what time should I get up in the morning? Tomorrow. And how do I want to show up at work? So how do you keep watch and guard your heart? Watch your words. Pay attention to what your eyes are looking towards and looking for. And then pay attention to the next step you take. Pay attention to the details, the path that you're on, because they lead somewhere. And so the first first approach to how do you guard your heart? It's interesting. All three of these anatomical features that are used in the back half of this chiasm describe things that flow out. The eyes that are looking out, looking around, the feet that are walking somewhere, and the speech that's coming out of you. How do you guard your heart? Look what's being produced by your life and guard it. Second, the first is your ears, your eyes, and your heart. And the posture here is not what's coming out, but what's coming in. And at the heart of this is this father saying to his son, listen to what I'm saying to you. Examine it with your eyes and keep it inside of you in your heart. In other words, this word that God our Father is declaring to us, speaking to us, the words that we're going to step into starting in chapter 10 next week as we begin to work our way through these different themes that arise in the book of Proverbs, to take these words and listen to them. And as you listen to them, examine them, meditate on them, think on them, try to understand them and grasp what they have to say, and last, hold on to them. Don't just let them kind of get into your head and then be jettisoned, but let them be things that you meditate on. Not only that you just hear once, not just that you try to understand what do they mean, that's where we're speaking of eyes there, but lastly, actually holding on to these words. And so there is, in the life of wisdom, how do we guard our hearts? Listen to, attend to, pay attention to the words that God is speaking to us. Not only in Proverbs, but the whole of Scripture. Listen to His words. Examine His words. And hold on to His words. Listen to, let the very words that are being spoken in this book come into your ears. Take them in. And then set your eyes on them to examine them, to understand them, to discern what they actually mean. And last, hold on to them, meditate on them. A passage of Scripture that a number of commentators pointed to with reference to this text in particular occurred in John's Gospel. In John's Gospel, Jesus is making this rather glorious promise about a destination to his disciples. He tells them that that he's going, he's going to leave them, and as he leaves them, he's going to go to be with his Father. And he's going to be with his Father, he's going to go and prepare a place for them, a destination, a place where they will arrive and live, where they will be with him and with the Father forever and ever and ever. And it's this beautiful, famous passage about, hey, I'm leaving you, I'm going to the Father, and you're going to come there eventually, but I'm going there now to prepare this place where you'll be with me forever, you'll be with the Father forever. And then Philip, right in the middle of that, asks this question, this question that is, oddly enough, a question about wisdom. He says, Lord, we do not know the way. That language here of language there of the path, of the trail, it's absolutely with as a Hebraism, it's a kind of way that they would speak to one another about. We don't know how we're supposed to live to get to that place. What are we supposed to do? What are the things that we're supposed to hang on to? How should we walk down that trail to get to this beautiful, glorious place, this place that you're going to prepare for us? And then Jesus gives a response that just blows the lid off for us. And it is what I would say for you is the source, the foundation of all wisdom. All real wisdom must come from Jesus' response in the Gospel of John here. But we're going to get into all kinds of details about how to approach money and how to approach sex and how to approach speech and marriage and work. But if it does not come from this fountain first, it'll just be folly. But what's interesting about Jesus' response is the response that he gives to Philip and to his disciples, it's unlike any other religious response that we know of. The question is a common one. We don't know the way. Teach us the way. And if you go to Buddha, if you go to Muhammad, if you go to any of these other religious systems, they have that question at the heart of them. We don't know the way. We need to learn the way. And then the instructions that you will get from every other religious system in the world, including secularism, which is, by the way, a religious system, is a list of behavioral instructions on what you should do next. Listen to Jesus' words. I am the way. Oh, Jesus' answer to the question, I don't know the trail I should take. I don't know how to get to that destination. Oh, before we talk about money, before we're going to talk next week about sex and self-control, before we, in a couple of weeks, we talk about what is the way of speaking that accords with wisdom, what is the way of approaching money that accords with wisdom, what is the way of approaching marriage and all of these other kinds of relationships that accords with wisdom, at the heart of all of them is this word from Jesus. I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except by me. So every week we come to this table, a table with bread and wine, a table at the center of which is the waters of baptism. Oh, if you follow your heart, it'll lead to death. If you try to muster your own life and kind of produce your own wisdom and your own path, you're eventually going to find your way just a field full of snakes. Oh, but come to Jesus. Receive his body and blood. Oh, come to Jesus and learn from him wisdom. Oh, come to Jesus and in his grace and in his mercy, find your heart transformed from a heart of darkness, a heart of evil, a heart of deception, to a heart that longs to hear and trust and obey all that Jesus would command us. Come to this table, receive grace, and then receive wisdom. Let's pray.